Well, one of the parts of the Bible that has gotten my attention a lot in the last little bit is the various translations of the Bible. As we well know, the Bible was written across huge swaths of time in several different languages. And each time a new translation is created, someone or a team of people, they have to comb through all of the text or text fragments that they have, and they have to try to make intelligent decisions on what the more accurate rendering should be. And even when they know what the original text is, sometimes they have to struggle to figure out how to translate a saying or a phrase that no longer fits into our modern vernacular. So they have to kind of think to themselves, well, should I render this phrase more literally of what those words mean, or should I render it in a way that the modern reader might be able to understand better? Languages, they change over time. Sayings and phrases, they evolve, of course. Sometimes when I hear Lucas and his friends talking, I feel like teens have a totally different version of English than what I understand. And even if the words stay the exact same, the meaning behind those words can change quite drastically. One example that I'm sure you've heard of before is the word awful. If you come up after this message and you say, "Mike, that sermonette was awful," that would be very cruel, because we understand awful to be a synonym of terrible. If something is awful, that's not a very pleasant experience. However, you know, the Oxford English Dictionary, they trace the roots of that word all the way back to the 1300s. And for the vast majority of the life of that word, it meant something like worthy of respect or fear, or striking someone with awe. So we still use the word awe even today. We could say to stand in awe, or you could be filled with awe. But to be awful, that's an entirely different thing altogether. So when we read the Bible in our various translations, sometimes we have to put a little translator to take the literal text printed on the page and apply that to our lives today. A very great example of this, and one that used to make me always chuckle as a kid, and not a few times as an adult, is any time we would come across the text in the Bible that said someone girded their loins. Which is a ridiculous way of saying they just got prepared. They prepared themselves. Literally, they wrapped their clothing in a way that gave them freedom of movement. But that's not super obvious from the text there. Well, I'd like to look at another example today, and you can turn to this one. It's back in Psalm chapter 44. Psalm chapter 44. And this one is a little bit more subtle, but I think it's a great example of where you read the text and you might already have a preconceived idea of what it means. And you're not far off, I wouldn't think. But you also might not be exactly right either. Psalm 44, and starting in verse 5, Psalm 44, verse 5, it says, "Through you we will push down our enemies. Through your name we will trample those who rise up against us." 4, verse 6, "For I will not trust in my bow. I will not trust in my bow, nor shall my sword save me, but you have saved us from our enemies and have put to shame those who hated us." All right, so keep that one in your mind. Now let's go to 1 Samuel 2. 1 Samuel 2, and we'll read verses 3 and 4 here. 1 Samuel 2, verses 3 and 4. 1 Samuel 2, starting in verse 3, says, "Talk no more so very proudly. Let no arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is the God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty men are broken, and those who stumble are girded with strength." Now, there are a lot of examples of this, at least references to bows, in the scriptures. In Job, for example, it's in there millions of times. It's in chapter 16, 20, 21, 26, over and over and over again. Now, if you're thinking about a bow and arrow, what first comes to your mind? Are you thinking about maybe like a child's toy where they have like rubber tips to them or something like that? Or even like a hunting weapon where someone is moving around like a little stealthily to make a move? In modern day movies, if someone has a bow and arrow, it's usually an actor that's portraying someone like a ninja or someone that's very stealthy, that's off in the corner or something like that. And in my mind, when the time the Bible was written, I visualized that there were armies that gathered together And in the front, that's where they put like their toughest soldiers. Those are like the most manliest of men. They're all ripped up with muscles. They're super strong, and they're just going to duke it out and fight it. But then, like in the back, that's where you're going to put the younger troops, maybe the physically weaker troops. And for them, you can put them behind a fortification, up on a wall somewhere, and they can just kind of shoot arrows in safety. In other words, the bow was a weapon, sure, but it was kind of like a second or a third rate kind of weapon. And if that's what you have in mind, well, you're not alone in this, but I want to challenge that. And for that, I'd like a volunteer. I asked poor Silas to come on up. You can come on up, Silas. I brought a prop with me. Brought a bow here. This is a modern day bow. This is about 35 years old, but it's still kind of considered modern because it's a compound bow. And I like Silas just to kind of give this a whirl and pull it back. Yeah. How is that? Is it easy, hard? How do you feel about it?
Kind of hard to pull it back too much.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much. You may see that. I won't shoot you as you walk back. I'll just let you walk right back. Thank you, Silas, for that. Now, as our friendly volunteer gathered, that bow is kind of hard to pull back. Even though it's a compound bow, its entire design was to get it so it's easier to pull back. But even so, that's a lot harder. That particular bow has a pull of 45 pounds. And we used it when we went hunting. It's effective for about 10 to 30 yards or so. Maybe a little bit more if the deer ran at you heart first or something like that. But they have uncovered different skeletons in the period of the English longbowmen, and they can determine just by looking at the skeleton which one were longbowmen. And you might think, well, how could they do that? I mean, soldiers and there's just bones in the field. How could they tell a bowman versus a foot soldier or something like that? And the difference is in the skeletal system. Back with the English longbowmen, some of their bows had a pull of over 200 pounds. 200 pounds each time they had to pull that back. So of course they would be doing that over and over and over, not just in war, but as they practiced throughout the day and things like that. So as a result, it changed the skeletal system of those troops. They had much broader shoulders, and in a lot of cases, one arm was actually longer than the other one from holding one and pulling with the other one. So actually, you could kind of put a club or a sword or kind of anything into the hand of a farmer and force them to the front of the line. But archers were actually a hot commodity in terms of the strength and the training and the power required to wield that weapon. The more of those that you had, the more formidable your army was. The old thought that tough grade A soldiers were in the front and the weenie kind of grade C archers were in the back, that's not accurate at all. Even in the Bible, in several places like 1 Chronicles 5 and 2 Chronicles 17 and many other places, archers are so important that they're numbered separately from the rest of the troops. They'll say, this group had this many troops and this many archers. And they wanted to know what that number was because it gave them a strategic advantage to have those archers. Well, you might think, what difference does it make in what we think about when we hear the word bow or archers? Well, quite simply, a misconception of the symbol of bow could have a misunderstanding of that symbolism as it's used within the Bible. In the Bible, the bow is a symbol of great strength and might. Those who control and wield the bow have the power. And when someone's bow has been broken, that is a sign that their strength is fully destroyed. Now, you can turn back there if you're fast, but I'm going to go to Jeremiah 49, verses 34 and 35. Jeremiah 49, verses 34 and 35. It says this: "The word of the Lord that came to Jeremiah, the prophet against Elam, in the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah." So how is God going to demonstrate that he's going to completely devastate Elam? Verse 35. "Thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, I will break the bow of Elam, the foremost of their might." The bow is the symbol of the might of that nation. And when that is then broken, the nation is toast. There are all sorts of images in the ancient Near East where when one kingdom defeats another kingdom and they carve out a relief or a statue that shows that victory, you'll see the defeated nation will come forth with a broken bow. That shows that they were fully defeated. And that imagery and that symbolism is used not just in that time frame, but throughout the Bible. For example, when thinking about the end times, as Mr. Core did last week, if you wanted to give a visualization of someone coming in great power and great might, someone as a conqueror, then what image would you use? Well, I'll just read it. This is the first of the four horsemen in Revelation 6. How would you symbolize that? Revelation 6, verse 2 says, "And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow." He had a bow. That's how they would symbolize someone coming as a great conqueror. Now, one of the later horsemen would have a sword, and he would be the one destroying. But the first one is a symbol of that conqueror, someone that is the image of someone that is powerful, the strongest, and is in control. So, of course, you would use a bow. Now, in conclusion, I do want to turn back to one more scripture. It's in Job chapter 30. Job chapter 30. It's the many references to bows in Job that got me thinking about this sermonette. And the verse in Job chapter 30, verses 10 and 11, is a great example of how sometimes we have to reset our preconceived ideas and instead of look through the lens of the writer to try to understand the nuances of the Bible. Job 30, verse 10 and 11, says, "They abhor me," this is Job talking, "they keep far from me, they do not hesitate to spit in my face, because he," that's God, "because he has loosed my bowstring and afflicted me, and they have cast off restraint before me." Job was saying he's not fully defeated, but his strength and his might have been zapped. He is a shell of who he was. And how does he get that point across? By showing that God has loosened his bow. He's taken the power right out of it and laid him bare as a shell. So I hope as we go through the Bible and we come across references to bows and archers, let's push aside our modern understanding of what that might be and link back to the powerful symbolism that the writer intended.